Welcome to Beautiful Ghosts. We are a community of people that have honest conversations, open up to others, and are willing to be vulnerable to grow and discover what is beautiful within us. Here is a new conversation with Mariana, Nico, Pablo, and you, searching for beautiful ghosts.
Let's go.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, good everything, good summer, good winter, good autumn. I don't know, wherever you are. Today, lucky us, we have the big smart hit of Rodrigo. He's a psychiatric and he wants to talk to us about addictions. Want to talk to him about addictions, really. So, do you want to start with something or do you want us to bombard you with questions about it?
Yeah, I mean, haven't heard a few of your previous episodes. My guess is that you probably want to go with the I'm Mariana, I'm Pablo, I'm Nico.
That's it. Okay, you're so right. Okay, hello, Pablo.
Hi, Mariana.
Hi, Nico.
Hi, Marian. Hi, Pablo.
Hi, Rodrigo.
Welcome, Rodrigo.
Should we start again?
and that's perfect so people recognize our voices.
That is good. Yeah. Good. Thank you.
And I don't know. I guess we could start with some questions. And my guess is that's going to lead to a conversation. Anyway.
Well, I'm going to start with a heavy story about addiction.
Go.
Sorry, I ruined from the beginning. No, my addiction was coffee. And I stopped drinking coffee when I was 19. And when I tell the story, when I start talking story, when I was 19, I had an addiction. People, you know, start like perk their ears to hear my story. And I was like, I used to drink 2 cups of coffee. And then I decided
coffee,
I wanted to quit.
That's the addiction. 2 cups of coffee was your addiction.
It was two.
I drink 3 every day.
The thing is, I needed them. I couldn't start my day without those cups of coffee, and I wanted to be able to start my day without.
Pablo, if a pee addict is listening right now to us,
I was thinking about the same.
Hey, I'm just going to stop this because if the guy thinks he has an addiction with 2 fucking coffees, he's not in touch with reality, basically. Really?
Okay, but let him. Maybe he has a point because maybe I think one of the interesting things he said was that he needed the coffee.
It's true.
So it's like putting the need into something that is external.
Rodrigo, would you consider that an addiction?
It's tricky, I guess. There is this psychiatric manual, the DSM, Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. And there is a 5th edition now of it. It has been changing over time according to like research and evidence and so on. And when a psychiatrist wants to make a diagnosis, then this person has to go and check with the manual and see, okay, there is this list of 11 symptoms and that you must match in the course of 12 months. And yes, one of those would be, for instance, withdrawal, which is this idea with this notion of this not feeling very well because you haven't consumed the substance or you have consumed less of it than usual. So you're not feeling okay. Mm. But once you consume it or you consume it as usual, then you feel okay. But that would be one of the symptoms. But the thing is now that you just need 2. Of this list of 11, and the other one could be something like craving for your coffee and thinking about it constantly, and that would be enough. So that's the thing. Potentially, yes, it could have been an addiction, but then comes the issue of how do we go with it, and there are these two huge dilemmas in the field about how to go at helping someone who has an addiction.
So what, which two avenues there is?
One is abstinence-based, an abstinence-based approach, like which claims basically, like the name says, that the only way you have to deal with an addiction is to stop consuming altogether, whatever it is that you're addicted to. And the other big branch, the other is a harm reduction approach, which is less about, it is more focused on reducing the harm that this this addiction is causing you.
So how can you reduce it? How can?
For instance, if you are addicted to heroin and you are injecting on the streets using the same needle and sharing needles, I have a harm reduction approach. I would come and say, look, the most important, you can stop if you want to. I mean, that's not what I'm here for. But I'm here for to let you know that you must use clean needles, because then you will avoid a bunch of illnesses that may come from sharing needles with other people. You might want to start small, be careful of the amount, you might overdose. And
in that avenue, you're not treating the addiction. You're just going like, hey, bro, just do it a little bit nicer. But the other one is like the opposite of like, okay, you have to stop, right?
And some would say that New Zealand has a harm reduction approach policy-wise towards addiction. So,
really?
Yeah, it is, and a lot of services focus on this idea of trying to reduce harm that could involve abstinence, but not necessarily.
Yeah, that's true, actually. In the commercials for alcohol and stuff, they don't say, don't fucking drink. They just go like, hey, if you drive and drink, or you are a bad person. That makes sense.
Yeah, don't cook and drink. There was this advertisement about, this promotion about,
that's true,
coming drunk at night and trying to fry something, and then you fall asleep because you're drunk, and that's dangerous. Or drinking when there is a chance that you might be pregnant, or drinking and driving.
But can I ask you, like, for me, all of those seems so shallow. Like, I'm not saying that the commercials were really well done, because you will never forget. It's not about the commercial. I'm saying none of it goes to the root. The same with the mental health campaign. If you're feeling bad, talk to someone. Reach out. 0800. What the fuck? Like, so you as a psychiatric, how, I'm not saying for you to criticize the system in New Zealand, just in general, like, do you see that people are trying to get more to the root of the problem? Like, of course, someone that was abused when they were 2 years old, nonstop until 10, and did not have a okay mother, they will be alcoholics. So that's the root. Mm-hmm. So is that how you think it? Or
there is a growing trend that I hope a part of this idea of something that has come thanks to public health mainly. This idea of this concept of the social determinants of health, like your health, which contrasts with the idea of lifestyle choices. Because on the one hand, you have this notion that someone who a person is making the wrong decisions and therefore is drinking a lot of alcohol, or not eating very healthy, or not exercising enough, or whatever. And these are lifestyle choices. It's almost like the locus of responsibility, the onus of change, is on the individual who needs to make better decisions. But there is a push to recognize exactly what you're saying, that nobody exists in a vacuum, and you are influenced and impacted, not by even just your current context, but by historical things that when your family and things like that. Yeah,
and it's great you mentioned that, because I'm surprised that in every movie, when people are having fun, they are drinking alcohol, and so if you have movies where you know the model is like, hey, let's have fun, let's go and just get drunk. How do you want then society not, you know, people not to think that drinking alcohol is fun?
Exactly. And at the same time, ideally, you would not only, what you would do, I guess, is address, of course, like, first of all, what you must do or aspire to do, because it might be hard on the long, is to change these social determinants of health, like employment, formal education, access to healthcare, and all of feeling that you have control over the things that have an impact on your life, on your health. So that's a massive thing. Like, if you don't have control over the things that have an impact on your health, and then on top of things, I come and tell you that, look, it's your responsibility to change your lifestyle. And it is you, I'm practically victimizing the victim again.
Yeah.
Yes, because I heard there was something going on with, can't remember who was the politic that it came out to the media saying that people that were having issues with eating, mostly obese people, there was someone that said something like, you just need to stop eating or eat healthy. Mm. And it doesn't work like that. It's not like, it's your choice. You can just stop eating unhealthy whenever you want. It's not like that. It doesn't work like that. If it has been ages, you have the beliefs, you have been, you know, your whole mind works on a different way. So it's just not so easy to say, stop it. You know, so, and I also think that that's part of the problem, and people just put them, there's no empathy on others, just looking at others from your own shoes and say, for you, it's maybe I don't drink coffee. And for me, like, not drinking coffee, it's not a burden, but maybe someone that eats, drinks lots of coffee, you know, stopping just one coffee less is going to make, it's really going to be really hard. And I cannot say, just stop drinking coffee.
But that's the lack of awareness in general of people. Like, they have no, because they, not many people do the internal work where they go like, I'm fucked up in this, or I could improve that. They just like always blame the others or put the others down. I think it comes more from that side, like sort of ignorant side.
Okay, you give me a good segue. So, what are the addictions, if you want to share, that you used to have? Not necessarily to the point that Rodrigo was saying about that manual, but like things that were maybe out of your control, really hard for you to say no, or maybe you wasn't aware, or, you know, what are the things that you had issues with?
I still have it. I'm still a tobacco smoker, for example. I never was hooked on any drugs. I'm not an alcoholic, or I never was hard to stop drinking a red wine or something. But the cigarette has been with me so long that I'm like, almost like I cannot imagine life without it. And it's fact. But I do know that when things are going good and I'm feeling fulfilled and I'm feeling on track of what I want to achieve in life, the consumption goes dramatically down. And then when I'm having stressful times, I'm like, and while I'm smoking, I'm like, this is not going to resolve it. What the fuck? But you still cannot do it. So, hey, I don't drink alcohol, but I understand that, you know, people with addictions like that, or shooting stuff. I don't know, you know?
I could potentially connect those two things, because there's something I wanted to say about what we were talking about before as well. And I also used to smoke. I started when I was like 14, 15, I'm 40. I stopped at 33, 30, something like that, 34.
That's good to know.
Yes, a while ago. And
did you do the abstinence, which avenue did you
do? I did. I was coming from Paraguay, and I had in my head, because back there, this idea of harm reduction is not very popular, was not while I was there. So in my head, it was either you stop or you stop. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that helped me to stop, and it is something I often talk about, is and this connects it with what we were talking about before. People sometimes is not so much, yes, it is a mixture perhaps of a lack of empathy or unawareness, but I think that the issue, some of the issue is that people who don't consume a substance take for granted whatever it is that they do, for instance, to deal with stress. They have naturalized it. They have done it enough that it has become a natural response to a stress. And when you want to stop a consumption of something, it is, yeah, that's part of it. But another part of it is also to start, I would say, you need to start practicing non-smoking, like non-smokers do, until the point you naturalize it. And that's also the thing that happens, and we can see this difference in society, that there are spots where people don't have a lot of chance to practice non-smoking because of their social networks, because there's a lack of access to other ways of coping with stress and the shit that happens in life. While there are larger spots, perhaps here in New Zealand at least, of people that have naturalized this non-smoking behavior, I guess. So when we're asking people to stop and people don't have access to the non-practice of it or whatever it would entail not to practice that consumption.
That is such a good, the non-practice, this aspect that you bring is like the same as destroying a software inside, a pattern that it keeps going over and over and over. So basically you are practicing the one, like, I don't know, I can
call rewiring.
Yeah, it's funny.
You were discussing, I think you were talking about habits, and you were discussing about this wiring and how there are triggers that lead to a certain behavior. And part of stopping smoking, for instance, is recognizing the triggers and trying to find alternatives that will not lead you to be triggered. Mm. But that has a lot to do with stopping. But there is also the part of, okay, what do I do then? Because I'm going to be losing something. And there is lost with giving up. And the whole phrases mean, there's. So there has to be also something, not that replace it, but an alternative. So what do I do? I remember waiting for the bus when I was smoking and watching people walking from one end of, from walking around the block. And I would think to myself, like, how can people walk and not smoke? Like, that doesn't make any sense. How can someone wait for the bus and not light up a cigarette? It's nonsense. But they have naturalized that. They have made it, something that seems natural. And people tend to, and that's the thing, people forget that healthy habits come from practice and your family background and access to resources that would lead to those. Those are not natural behaviors, like non-smoking, non-drinking to have fun.
So can I ask you, because, like, you know, we live in a society where drinking alcohol is part of life. That's it. They don't imagine a barbecue without alcohol. It's ridiculous. While, you know, if you go to South America, hey, come for lunch and maybe there is just Coke and Sprite, right? So what can you give us about that? What can you say about that? Is it the same? This practice for generations, Anglo-Saxons, of, okay, let's shoot a tequila to cope with how happy we are right now. Or what can you say about that?
What I like, that's to come to an answer, but through a different angle. That's one of the things that I like about harm reduction, is this idea that, yes, there is consumption, that because of cultural, historical things have come to be embedded in how people socialize and celebrate and share and create connections with others. Like in China, there's a lot of, I've been told, that sharing a cigarette is an important aspect of welcoming a guest in some places. And for us, it would be like sharing a coffee, for instance, or having a drink together. And these are, and also celebration involves, I remember a birthday party without alcohol, like was, yeah. It, you would have to specify that there was not going to be alcohol, because the taken for granted is, yeah, of course, there's going to be alcohol.
Yeah.
Yeah, really. I have two questions. The first one is the harm reduction.
Yeah.
So that's one of the avenues you were saying. Would that be one step of the process? Because, okay, maybe you're, in your example about the heroin addict, okay, so now you start, you're still doing heroin, but at least you're using your own needle, for example. But what comes after? So that's my first question. And my second question is, how do you, in my case, for example, my addiction would be overthinking.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little bit different, because there's no necessarily a substance. It's more intellectual, or, you know, just maybe, yeah. So what, just want to hear your thoughts about both things.
About harm reduction, I think the idea with harm reduction, unfortunately, is we come to think about it through what we know. And basically what we often know is abstinence, and this idea that there are addiction, or there is only good consumption of whatever, and bad consumption is being addicted, basically. So there are people who drink alcohol, and then there are alcoholics, and there are, I don't know, that's how we tend to think. But the idea of harm reduction, what it brings to the table, is this notion that if we think about it as a pyramid, for instance, we would have at the top of the pyramid the people who are very heavily addicted to alcohol, for instance. And that would be 5% of the population. I'm just making up numbers here.
Yeah.
Then below that, you would have a number of people who are very hazardous drinkers and almost about to become addicted to it, because, yeah, they're drinking almost every day and so on, but they could stop without having withdrawal symptoms and what. So that would be, I guess, 15% of the population. But your vast majority of the population is going to be people who drink alcohol regularly without necessarily always drinking it at a risky
level. Yeah.
But they would occasionally drink in a risky manner.
That's true.
And the number is so big that even if a few of this larger number of the population drink it hazardously, then you have car accidents, you have, I don't know, and all these behaviors that can be delinquent. The idea of harm reduction, what it does is it says, let's focus less on the, if we focus only on people who have developed this very heavy addiction, we're focusing on a very small part of the problem that the substance is causing.
And very interesting.
A larger amount of harm that is being caused at other levels. So let's try to deal with it at all levels. So it is, and what would happen with that person who, so that's just to talk about harm reduction is what it brings to the table. But if we talk exclusively about clean needles and things like that, it has made a huge change in it has reduced the HIV epidemic. It has reduced sharing needles when it stopped. It has done a lot of good to people. Overdoses go down if you, for instance, offer a safe place for people to inject. And so, and the cost of that issue to the society goes down a lot as well. So you're reducing not only the harm to that individual, but also to the society. And being non-judgmental about how you're approaching the issue makes it so much easier for the person to, whenever he or she or they decide to stop, they know they can access healthcare because they are not going to be judged, and they are welcomed, and they won't be preached with them. So it changes the way in which the healthcare system relates with people with a substance use problem. Now about overthinking, I'm thinking about it. And I think the problem, I know someone like who would, there was, I guess, an addiction, and this is often how it is described. It starts with a consumption that is enjoyed. So you would have your, because it has to produce that rush of dopamine.
Yeah, dopamine.
Yes. Exactly. What happens if you were to understand an addiction as a biological problem, which I think it's reductionist, but it helps to explain it. It's, you would have this rush of dopamine, and then you would need it again. And there is a point where your body gets used to it, and you just have to consume it, not so much for the rush, but just to keep yourself level. That's the normal story of how addiction. I don't know if overthinking has.
Yeah, maybe it's not a. Maybe I'm not addicted. Maybe it's not an addiction. But yeah, okay, fair point.
Yeah.
But it's interesting what you're saying about the dopamine, because maybe that, especially now with social media, smartphones, those things that's what it generates. Then you kind of need it. Because that's the purpose of the social media. They are created part to generate that effect. That's why they are so addictive.
Now, just not to keep hanging, the idea of overthinking as something, as a coping mechanism, though, that can be helpful. You might not be addicted to it, but it's a way of coping. And instead of exploring alternatives, it's your go-to, and it's the one you're familiar with, and so it's a familiar space.
Yeah.
What could you say that it will be good to practice instead of overthinking?
You would potentially, I guess, use the same strategies that you would use with someone who is trying to reduce drinking, for instance, or stopping to smoke. You would ask that person, if you go at it from like a CBT, you would ask that person to keep a diary of, to be able to recognize what triggers that, and what you were thinking before and what you were thinking afterwards, and kind of like to recognize when it happens.
Okay,
that's great. That's great.
And then you can start working alternatives to that. So instead of that, I'm going to take a deep breath and focus on my breath. And do a little bit of mindfulness, like a minute or two.
Yeah, that helps me a lot, definitely.
But you were saying social media, people from social media and like this app business, it's the amount of cleverness that goes into trying to keep you using the app is amazing. There are all these little tricks like the roulette thing, the poking machine.
Oh, yeah. I read it's the same effect.
Because you're scrolling down and something good might come. It's almost like
the poking machine.
And the colors are made to make you feel like you were in a casino. The tactile sensation of the phone. There is a lot of thinking that goes into ensuring that you won't let your phone down. Because then you are not being a useful product, because at the end of the day, you are the product of those apps. They need you in front of them.
It's like a coping mechanism, as you say. And I tell you one story really shortly, but just before here, I was walking my dog, and my dog starts to play with a maybe 7-year-old kid. And, you know, the kid looked like he was enjoying it and stuff, so I'm like, oh, okay, well, I stay here. And then I interacted a little bit with the kid, and we were like three of us playing, and then suddenly he's like, wait a minute, gets out a big Samsung Pro X10 big thing and says, I have another 5 minutes left, and after that I have to go. I put it back, he plays 2-3 minutes. And then he's like, bye. What? So it's even also to, you know, it's an excuse to leave situations. It's an excuse to not cope with whatever is happening there. You know, like the phone goes beyond what is like given. I don't know.
It has taken over. Probably mom made a useful use of the phone and said, okay, look, you have to be here at whatever time, and knowing that he's going to be looking at his phone every 3 minutes, then okay, there's no way he or she or they would not know the time, because they're always checking their phone. And even if
it's in this manual, they're not even thinking about putting addiction to the phone.
That's tricky, because there is a discussion whether people are addicted, for instance, to the internet, which is the medium that leads to the consumption of gambling, gaming, social media? Or are you addicted to this particular content that is given by that medium? So that's the thing that is hard to break down and to say, okay, what is it exactly that the person cannot stop? Is it internet or is it,
well,
is it
game? That's all true. In the past, it used to be different because I remember you have to connect to the internet. Remember that you are not online all the time. You have to dial up. If you were lucky and no one picked up the phone, you were able to connect.
Yeah.
And maybe you were online and someone picked the phone up and then it stopped the connection. So, and it was different and it was quite expensive to be connected for a long period of time. So you have to be very, very sure the amount of time you're going to be connected.
Yeah.
But now you are, I'm actually with my phone having this conversation in a camping and I'm using like internet, you know, so it's nonstop. It's harder.
But that's a very good point because you are, for instance, now connecting to your supportive network.
Exactly.
And for some kids, that's also the case. And it's hard for older generations to realize that, I don't know, I'm going to make this up, but perhaps people would go to the mall or they would go to the park or they would go to wherever. But now you go to Club Penguin or you go to play that game.
Roblox.
That multiplayer thing. And that's what you're going to talk about with your friends at school the next day. So it has become also the place of connection with your friends. And if you don't let your kid play, it could, and again, I'm making this up because I don't know, you might be diminishing that kid's chances to socialize or to make friends and things like that. Yeah.
I think that's important because the reason why not many people are worried about addiction, let's say being a workaholic or addiction to social media, is because, well, you could argue how much harm is that person really suffering, right? And being, you know, there are many other addictions that are causing like real physical harm, which is, you know, almost immediate or can put members of society, other members of society in danger. While you have, okay, addiction to internet is probably not the best way, or to social media is probably not the best way to spend your time. But, well, how much society is going to worry about that when, you know, there's still arguments whether kids playing a lot of video games is bad for them or not. And,
it is a good point. And harm is a key word there, because if the kid is not doing that well at school because playing all day, or actually not having friends because of it and connecting with people where there is no real connection. It's not classmates from school, but people who you don't know. It could be like a 40-year-old guy playing the game, and that's the person connecting with your 11-year-old. I don't know. So there's no real real deep friendship there, and I don't know. So Harm is a key word there, and it could cause harm, but it might not as well. So we need to draw the line. Yeah.
I want to ask you. Oh, sorry. What?
No, I was because I really want to share if you have any addiction.
Me?
Yes. I'm curious.
No. Well, I mean, in the previous program, I mentioned. Well, I mean, I do, in the sense, if I wanted to stop eating carbohydrates or sugar, which I tried, it's really hard. And it's known that, you know, sugar and carbohydrates are addictive. But I do feel that they're not causing me much harm. So that's why I don't worry about it. But I did try to do, for example, the keto diet or things like that, to see, can I, you know, reduce or almost eliminate eating sugars or carbohydrates, and it didn't work for me. And they say that the keto diet is such a great diet, but when I tried it, and I don't know, you know, they say you have to do it like, you know, for several weeks to start noticing the effects. I did it like for 1 week, and I was like, oh, this is not working for me.
Did it change your mood? I'm just curious.
Yeah, it's not a good mood because you're hungry. Yes. You gotta have a warning to your family. Warning, I'm doing the keto.
Yeah. Keto and no sugar diet. Like.
But what about you, Rodrigo? Do you, because fuck, you are a professional in addiction. So if you have one, you fucked and you are the first one to know it.
And I actually
and you have to own it.
Yeah. And it was when I came to New Zealand, I started with this PhD on, and part of it was about giving up smoking. So it was, okay, I have to give up because it would be just so weird to ask people and try to, yeah. So that was part of it. Of course, something else that helped a lot was that.
You can always say that you are not addicted. Just kidding.
People do say that. There are people who smoke on the weekends and they would not call themselves
casual smokers.
Or casual smokers.
Or social smokers.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry, I interrupt you.
Sorry.
No, I was going to say that sometimes, you know, when I think about how I thought about those things, like I never smoked and I would never start one cigarette because I know why would I start something that later on may become an addiction and it's harmful for your health. But that, of course, then we go into the, well, but people will do it for coping mechanisms, peer pressure, cultural norms and things like that, right?
Exactly. It's great that you had a chance not to do it and still have a fulfilling relationships and other ways of enjoying yourself and share a good time with others. So that it's great to have had that chance.
My question is related to this. You know, with the cases you have studied or the cases you've seen, do you recognize like a pattern in personality between, okay, the smokers, they have this, the alcoholics, they have this, like the heroin addict, the, I don't know, the anorexic one, whatever. Can you like sort of have one thing that they have in common that you think that's makes them addict to that?
I don't know. I mean, I guess because what you're doing is you're really just applying the rule when you are diagnosing someone with an addiction. And there is in this manual, so what you would be doing is basically, it's kind of like this game the kids play. You have the star, the triangle, the square, and then this cube that has the square. So what you're doing is, okay, the person is the cube, and you're just trying to see which shape, which is, addiction. And that's your diagnosis.
Yeah.
And there is no shape. There has been discussions, and it's colloquial. It has become part of our colloquial narrative that there is an addictive personality.
Yeah.
But there is no shape of that in the DSM, in the psychiatry.
There's maybe there are all the shapes. The shape changes.
Now, you need a person to consume a certain substance. You could say that there is perhaps, there could be definitely a connection with, like, if you are, perhaps it's...
I know what you, we're going to. That you are, if you are drinking alcohol,
If you are, you have social anxiety, there are those connections, like social anxiety and alcohol, but that's also, again, a matter of access, because you wouldn't be able to go to a party and have cocaine in the bathroom because you have social anxiety. Mm. And that would be your entry point to, it's more likely that you will go, you will feel awkward, there will be wine or beer and you will have that. And that would be how you will start your relationship.
That's true. Yeah.
That's a hard one. It's exactly what Paul was talking about. How you, because it is a relationship overall. And there are this theory around addiction that describes it as a relationship with a substance that consumes the energy from other relationships.
Mm.
And it's like an octopus, and all the tentacles go to the substance, and they're not connected anymore to work, friends, family, and so on. So
that's a good point, because like sometimes I think completely unconscious, but sometimes I think I smoke because I always felt different to my family, and I was like, you know, the black sheep and like going away and being different and stuff. And like, you know, at 14, my boyfriend at the time gave me one and it just hooked. From that day on, I will go to the kiosk to buy. Like, there was no questions asked. It was like, boom, a friend.
That's also a very good point, this idea of, some would say that you smoke because you are a smoker. Therefore, for instance, if you want to stop smoking, one of the first things that you need to do is change your self-label and start seeing yourself or calling yourself a non-smoker and see if you could, and start then practicing the practice that are attached to that identity.
But do you think that works? Because that is still, to me, like, I try to think that, but I do it twice and I'm like, oh, fuck, this is stupid.
I personally, I think it's the other way around. I think, again, going back to our idea of you need to practice non-smoking. I think you need to practice non-smoking, and it is through that practice that you will develop the identity. But you have to have a chance to practice it and practice it. So you don't become a professional football player because you decided to, or I don't know. There are things that you develop the identity through practice.
But for example, someone in my family, and this was in Europe, he became addicted to heroin really bad, to the point that he ended up having a gun and going to a bank to rob it to have more money for heroin. He got caught and stuff. So then after jail, he comes and lived to a place where I was staying for a month, and I had the chance to talk to him, right? And basically what he will be going to the toilet every 3 hours with something that he brought from the fridge. And I said, what are you doing? Oh, well, because I'm in a program to rehabilitate from heroin. And basically, I think they were like small doses. They will still inject, but it was more, I think it was morphine. I'm not sure. And I said, but can I ask you why? Why did you start to get hooked to heroin? And he said, Mariana, heroin is 10,000 better than sex. And I'm like, oh, okay. You know, at that time, I was quite young to understand. And I'm like, and he said, the peace you feel, you can never feel it without it. Like nothing matters and you are one with it. You know, he started to describe like, it was ecstasy. Mm-hmm. Right?
Guys, I don't want to ruin the party. I think we are already, it's getting, we should be wrapping up. So maybe it would be good if we can have just a couple of minutes more.
Okay.
Finish the story, Marianne.
Yeah. If you can just help me with that. Like, so for example, the heroin guy or the guy that drinks every day after work those beers and he doesn't think he's an alcoholic, but he is.
Like, but he feels great. Isn't that your point? That they feel great?
Exactly. You know, that's my point. So
for me, it's good. It makes me feel good, right?
Yeah.
It is not, it doesn't happen. What is hard to understand is because we are thinking about it from where we're standing. And it seems like it is just one step from not being there to being there.
Mm.
But there is a lot that happens in between and that normalizes and a lot of things. And part of it is also the development of this identity of an addict and normalizing consumption and the things you need to do around it and also justifying. And there is a lot that happens in that process of becoming an addict, let's say. It is that process that we're missing when we're thinking about it as just one jump. And once you are over there, part of it involves, yes, of course, nobody wants to think that you are stupid. Like it's hard to think I am killing myself or I'm doing this. while you would recognize it at times. So you live with this ambivalence, or I don't want to do it, but I love doing it. But and the point is that when you start talking to someone who is at that stage, whichever point you present to that person is going to argue for the counterpoint. So if I were to tell you, for instance, Mariana, you need to stop smoking, the first thing that would come to mind is, yeah, but the thing is that it helps. So that's it. That's why it is not helpful for me to try to trigger that discourse within you. Okay. All you have to do, if anything, is ask you, what are the pros? What are the cons? And you would come up with those on yourself. And then, yeah, but if you, yeah, I don't know if that answers your question.
No, yeah.
I think it's a very good point. Yeah.
So basically, it's a little bit about the process. Like, and everyone says, it's the person that needs to say, I want to stop. I had a fuck enough. Like, I had enough. I don't want to be an alcoholic in the gutters every day throwing up at 6 a.m. Like, there is a little bit of, that's it, right? Or
it is definitely a process. And relapsing is part of the process. That is something that it is important to recognize, because otherwise you think you have failed. But yeah. What has happened is, it is just you had a try, and you learn things from the try, and you're taking that to your next try. That might happen along the way. So relapse is not necessarily failure. It's part of the process of trying to stop it. Yeah.
And we talked a lot about forgiveness and loving ourselves in the process, because if every time you fucked it up in the process, you start blaming yourself, feeling guilty, feeling bad, it just goes down. So it's accepting that you have this limitation and start over.
Absolutely. But again, emphasizing that a lot of it has to do as well with the context in which you are, because otherwise it seems that we are again placing a lot of responsibility within the individual and making it almost like a lifestyle again thing.
Yeah. It's into that. That's a good point.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Should we say
I have nothing more questions.
Me too. I have more. Maybe, as we said, with our guests, that gets really, really interesting. We could have a second round with Rodrigo, because excellent. I think it was a great episode.
Yeah.
Any final thoughts?
Do you Pablo, want to say something? Sorry. Yes.
No. Yeah.
Rodrigo, yeah.
Well, I guess a few of the things that we were talking about, it is, perhaps to someone who is listening and it's consuming a substance or a behavior to the point that it's causing harm and you are thinking about stopping, first of all, great. That's the very first step. And the other thing is, like you were saying, be kind to yourself. It is a process. Relapse is part of the process. Making mistakes is part of it. But an important part of the recovery process is also connecting with people who are going to support you in that process. Yeah. It is going to be very, very hard to do it on your own and trying to make it just by driving, just by using your own energy, drawing from people's connections and from others' experiences. That's key. So
hits a good point, because another practitioner we had, he says part of any healing is with the interconnectivity with others.
Absolutely. So, and it doesn't speak against you. It's not that you don't have enough will, you don't have enough strength. On the contrary, if you are willing to accept that you need help, that requires a lot of strength. Yeah.
That's a good one. Okay.
Excellent.
Nico, well, Pablo?
No, just to thank Rodrigo for your words of wisdom. And it was really interesting. And the only thing I would like to say to the audience, well, thanks very much for listening. And there is one addiction that I can recommend, and that's addiction to listening to our podcast.
Of course!
But if anyone in the audience, we really appreciate your listening. And if you'd like to follow Rodrigo on Twitter, his Twitter handle is @ Rodrigo Ramalho, and that's RodrigoRamalho.
Nice. And Rodrigo, I'm really open at becoming addicted to your Paraguayan soup. So, just hit that text to Nico and we can go to your place and eat it.
Perfect. And some chipa.
And chipa.
Oh.
Yes. Oh my God. No, Nico, you want to say anything?
No, you said everything that I wanted to say as well. So, also good.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, guys.
Rodrigo, if you've seen our podcast, we now say high five to, we do high five to the camera. 1, 2, 3. Ciao. Hope you enjoyed this conversation of beautiful ghosts. We invite you to join our community in our Facebook page. Get in touch if you'd like to talk with us or be a guest in the podcast. To find out when new conversations are being published, subscribe to the YouTube channel or in your favorite podcast app. Our website is beautifulghosts.org. We appreciate your feedback and comments. Have a beautiful week.